Blog Talk Radio.
The HD View.
Monday, everyone, and thank you for tuning in to the HD View. This is your host, Melissa Biliardi. Our call-in numbers are 310-982-4227 and 877-497-4103. When you call in, press 1. We will cue you into the show. Tell all your colleagues, friends, and family about Health for HD Radio and click follow on our show page to get email reminders of upcoming episodes. Thank you, 83,000 listeners, for tuning in. Today's incredible special guests are Ron Bartek, co-founder and president, and Jen Farmer, executive director, coordinator of FARA. That is the Friedreich's Ataxia Research Alliance. It is a national public 501c3 nonprofit tax-exempt organization dedicated to finding curing Friedreich's ataxia, or FA, through research. And FARA was founded in September 1998 by a group of patient families and three of the world's leading FA scientists. We're going to talk to Ron and Jen today specifically about a patient registry that they began, and it's shown to give an acceleration to research and accelerate clinical trials. So let's welcome Ron and Jen. How are you today?
Thank you, Melissa. I'm doing fine.
It's so great to
have you on
the show.
Hi, Melissa. Thank you.
Yeah.
Hi, Jen. And Katie's with us, too. Hi, Katie.
Hi, guys.
So let's talk about a little bit about orphan diseases, because FA is also an orphan disease similar to Huntington's. So tell us, explain to us what FA is and how they discover it and how it's diagnosed.
Okay. I'll tell you what it is, as you indicated, Melissa, it's a rare disease like Huntington's, which means in U.S. terms there are fewer than 200,000 American patients. And in our case, we're quite rare. Our rough estimate is maybe 5,000 Americans have FA, and maybe worldwide something on the order of 15,000. So it's quite rare. It's a neuromuscular disease in which our patients lose strength and coordination in all four extremities. So their arms and legs, lose strength and coordination. That usually puts them in a wheelchair in their teen years if they're diagnosed between, as most are, between the ages of 5 and 15. And they also lose some vision, hearing, and speech. They get a severe scoliosis or curvature of the spine, requiring surgical implantation of metal rods to straighten and keep their spine straighter. Mm-hmm. They have a much increased risk of diabetes. And they have a very condemning heart condition. A hypertrophic cardiomyopathy is the way it usually begins. And that's the symptom that usually leads to early death. So on average, we lose our patients in early adulthood. And I'll maybe let Jen deal with how it's diagnosed.
Sure. Thanks, Ron.
Hi, Jen.
Ataxia. Hi, Melissa. Friedreich's ataxia, like Huntington's disease, is a genetic condition, and there's a single gene that we call frataxin that is abnormal in this disease, and it's also like Huntington's in that the mutation is a triplet repeat that has expanded in the gene, except that one of the differences that the DNA sequence in FA is GAA, and that GAA repeat is something that can be measured, and that is used as genetic testing for the disease. Another difference between FA and Huntington's, though, is the way the disease is inherited. So in Huntington's, you all know it's a dominant condition where a single gene abnormality causes the disease. In FA, the disease is recessive, and you have to inherit an abnormal GAA repeat from each parent. So parents are carriers and don't have symptoms, but if two parents are carriers, then their children are at risk. And so genetic testing in FA is really the gold standard of diagnosis. Go ahead, Melissa. You were asking a question?
Is there a test that two individuals – yeah, is there a test that two individuals can – that would tell them what – they're
not
their children
are
going to be at risk?
Yeah. So we don't have testing yet, sort of preconception or even at the newborn screening level yet.
Okay.
Individuals aren't diagnosed until they start showing the symptoms of ataxia and decreased coordination. So, but once we know, once somebody in a family is diagnosed, other family members who are at risk to be carriers or to be affected can be tested.
So one illustration of that would be my
so
family.
So then what is the...
We had three boys, and as soon as we got the diagnosis, after our middle son was diagnosed, after he was symptomatic, we decided, and it's a very personal decision, to test our other two, even though they were not symptomatic. And we discovered that we had all three possible manifestations. Our eldest boy was clear. He didn't get either mutation. The youngest boy was a carrier like his biological parents, so he had one mutation and one normal allele. And the middle son, Keith, got both mutations, so thus was a patient. So you can get diagnosis before symptoms, but only, as Jen said, usually it would come if the first child's diagnosed and the parents decide to go ahead and get the others, tested.
Mm-hmm. So then if they don't have it, then they won't carry it?
Right.
Is that how it works?
They can be clear. In other words, as Jen said, it's a recessive trait, so you have to get both. You have to get a mutation from your mother, mutation from your father to have the disease. But if you get one of those mutations, you will not have symptoms, but you will be a carrier like your parents and run the risk of when you marry and have children. If your spouse is also a carrier, then each child of that union has a 1 in 4 chance of being a patient. So, yep, that's the way it works.
Wow.
And we're
well, now,
like
you
so many
your
other
organization.
Go ahead.
No, please go ahead.
Okay. I was just going to say that you know, like several other diseases of this type, we're very eager to get our first approved treatment. We don't have one yet because when we do, we believe we have the other requirements to go on to the newborn screening panels across the country, and that way we would diagnose at birth and begin to administer treatments to infants and have a much broader window of treatment opportunity. And so we're really eager to get that first approval, and we think that will change the nature of our effort.
Now, is FA looking at gene silencing technology?
Well, we don't need to
right now?
Silence the gene because our – well, Jen, why don't you go ahead and do that one? Jen is a professional genetic counselor, so she is her stock in trade.
So even though we have a triplet repeat mutation, ours is a little bit different in how it misbehaves. So in Huntington's, that triplet repeat causes an abnormal protein to get formed. And in FA, what happens is that triplet repeat acts like a roadblock. And so we don't get enough protein at all. But when we do get protein, it's perfect protein. So our mutation is sitting in a non-coding region of the gene, acting like a silencer. And so our strategies are more towards turning that gene on and silencing that triplet repeat. So our treatment strategies are a little bit different in that regard.
Okay.
So that really empowers our genetic
You founded
approaches.
The organization in 98.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Oh,
and you started with three of the world's leading FA scientists.
Right. Yeah, we got our son's
diagnosis. And how did you...
We got our son's diagnosis in 97, a year after the gene was identified. So we met at our old Gateway computer that night, my wife and I, and sort of web searched Friedreich's ataxia and saw that there were no treatments and precious little research going on. And no organization devoted entirely to supporting that research in FA. So the good news we saw, though, was the gene had been identified the year before, March of 96. And so we sat there in tears and embraced and said, here we are living in the Washington, D.C. area, both of us working on Capitol Hill in the U.S. Congress, and about 30 minutes from the NIH and the FDA, and so maybe we could help by starting a foundation, and if we could gather enough resources to that foundation, maybe we could really help make a difference. And so we found these three leading scientists by going to friends at the NIH, or going to our newly found friends at the NIH, and we started contacting those scientists and sitting down with them. They agreed right away to serve as our scientific review committee and directors of the board, and we identified seven other parents like ourselves and one adult patient, and got everyone's buy-in to start the foundation, filed our incorporation papers, and got incorporated in September of 98, and the next day delivered our workshop application to the NIH. And so 4 months after that, we were given our IRS status as a 501c3, and 2 months after that, we held the world's first international scientific conference in FA right there at the NIH, and it was co-funded and co-hosted by the NIH. So that's how we got started.
That's an amazing story. Now, how many people are you having in attendance at your symposiums?
That's a great question. And the first one we did in 1999, we really had to go around the world telephonically and by email to convince scientists that they should spend 3 days with us in Bethesda, Maryland at the NIH. And pretty much the criterion was if you could spell Friedreich's ataxia, you were on our team. And so, but with all those phone calls and emails, we garnered 65 scientists from around the world to join 15 at the NIH who knew something about the disorder. And so that first international conference in, centered on May 1st, 1999, had those 80 scientists.
Wow.
And no drug companies. We called a lot of them, but none of them were interested. We were too rare. We were on our own, as they said. And one other advocacy organization joined us. But then leaping forward to the fourth one we did in 2011 in Strasbourg, France, Jen had to turn away, wasn't it like 30 or 40 scientists, Jen, to... keep it at a manageable 200, because that's all the auditorium would hold, even with an overflow room and scientists sitting on the floor. And there were about a dozen drug companies at our side at that point, helping us fund the conference. And a number of them had drugs in clinical trial for us. And there were 10 other advocacy organizations, not only helping fund their contingents from their countries, but also co-funding grants with us. So that's the way the organization has been able to, grow the field. We knew that was the big challenge. Too few scientists, too little money, and too little research going on. And we have, over those 15 years now, it's hard to even say that, because we thought we'd be able to get the job done in 15 years, but we were dreaming. And at any rate, we've grown it substantially.
Fantastic. So when did you start? You started a patient registry in 2007?
Yes. We had the idea that we would need a patient registry, a little bit earlier, but it took us about a year to get the whole thing organized and launched. We knew from a lot of the other researchers that there was a need to start to reach patients for natural history studies, biomarker studies, and clinical trials eventually. And, we saw the need to have a mechanism to do that. And also, to get a better handle on how many people are out there and how effectively can we reach them. So we started, this was my very first project actually with Farah. I was still working at the University of Pennsylvania at the time as a genetic counselor and research coordinator, and Ron came to me and said, can you help us put together a patient registry?
Couldn't say no.
Exactly.
So then you have some other, you have another institution or somebody else helping you with the natural history study?
Yes, the natural history study is run through the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia and the University of Rochester. But again, that was, Farah helped establish that natural history study and, provided the initial support needed to all of the investigators to get them going, and we've continued to support those efforts, and we've had some good collaborations with other advocacy groups like the Muscular Dystrophy Association in helping our natural history study. But, sometimes people confuse the two words, registry and natural history study. So
right.
Maybe for this, for your audience, I'll qualify that when I use the two words. So when I say natural history study, I'm referring to a registry that is really moderated by physicians. So in order to be enrolled into that registry, you have to go see one of the physicians. They do a detailed exam. They get all your medical records. And it's really the physician and their staff who are entering all your information into that natural history study or registry. So Farah has that in collaboration with, other researchers. But we also saw the need for something that was a little bit more accessible and more flexible. It might not be as robust in terms of the data that you collect, but again, is more accessible, especially to patients, and has fewer barriers to participation. And so our registry, what we call our registry, is a web-based registry. Anybody with FA can go on, no matter where they live, and enter their information. And we collect, demographic information. We collect some basic clinical information, like the age you were diagnosed, your first symptom, information about your genetic test results. And then we ask you questions about your interest in participating in research. The reason that we saw the need for the registry, and the primary use of our registry is to recruit patients for clinical studies, whether it's our natural history study or a biomarker study or a clinical trial. We can use the registry as a communication tool to email everybody and say, hey, this study's going on and they need subjects.
That's fantastic, and it's proven to be very successful already, right?
Yeah, I think so. We have, you know, just this past year, there were three separate clinical trials that we recruited patients for, and their trials filled very, very quickly. One of them involved 60 subjects at three different locations, and this particular study only recruited adults with FA. So I was able to go into the registry and pull everybody in the United States who's over 18 years of age and email them the recruitment notice for the trial. And 2 hours after I did that, one of the sites called me and said, we're full, stop. We can't take anymore.
Oh, my.
So, I, you know, I've
That's
had...
That's a good problem to have, right?
Yeah, it is a good problem to have. So I think the registry has been very successful in terms of being a recruitment tool for clinical trials. And one of the ways in which it's also been helpful for us that we're starting to use it, you know, more now is helping us identify where people with FA are. For example, we didn't realize that there was a significant incidence of FA in India. We could predict that, you know, that there would be some people in India who have the disease, but, you know, we didn't have a real sense of that. And through the patient registry, because it's very accessible online, anybody can join, we now know that there's a good number of people in India with FA. And this becomes important as more and more clinical trials start to begin, because we'll need, because we're a rare disease, you know, patient participation in clinical trials is critical. And some of these trials, if they have to enroll not 60 people but several hundred individuals, we may have to look outside the United States for other places where patients can be involved in research. And I would say even more important than that, you know, hopefully we'll be successful and have some approved drugs. And we're going to want to get those information about those approved medications to patients as quickly as possible. And that's sort of the next, I think, big use of our patient registry is going to be able to push out to patients new information about treatment.
And we really cannot overemphasize the importance of both of those tools that Jen's just explained so adroitly, the natural history study and the patient registry, just powerful magnets for scientists, you know, scientific investigators, and really powerful magnets for the industry, for the pharmaceutical industry, because now we have increasingly pharmaceutical companies coming to us well before they've got their hands on their well-defined clinical candidate, because they want to sit down with our key opinion leaders and with them mine the natural history study to learn about such things as the best clinical outcome measures, the best potential biomarkers, and then start to design their clinical studies by what segment of the population would most likely respond to their drug, you know, how ambulatory or non-ambulatory might these patients be for maximum benefit, and then when they know that Jen can push the button on the patient registry and recruit their trials in hours. You know, and we do that. To date, we've done that for free. And these companies are the same ones who are accustomed to getting NIH money or spending their own money to do a clinical trial whose recruitment requires 2 or 3 years, which costs them a lot of time and money. They know they can come to us and recruit a trial in hours, and they know they will save a lot of money and a lot of time. So these are powerful, powerful tools that help draw investigators and industry partners.
Very, very good. Now, as far as the natural history study, and that's being done through Children's Hospital in Rochester, are you finding that the majority of your patients are younger children?
Actually, no. So the natural history study is at 10 sites, 8 in the U.S., 1 in Canada, and 1 in Australia. And we have over 700 patients enrolled, and only half of them are kids. The other half are adults. And of the adults, a good number of them have later onset FA, so after the age of 20.
Oh, wow. So then are you also coordinating the natural history study and the registry, or is the natural history study being done aside from what you're doing?
They are done in parallel, but they're not together.
Okay, right. Because of the nature of natural history study.
But Jen is the coordinator of both. Yeah, so.
Okay, wow. That's a big job.
Yeah.
Well, there are lots of issues with the natural history study related to your health information. So the natural history study, you know, has a lot more detailed medical history and medical information in it. So that actually has to be done in a way that is HIPAA compliant and protects patients' identity and medical records and that kind of thing. And, you know, it's the two can't, the two don't cross. The two are separate.
Right, right.
And the other power of that natural history study, of course, is that, as Jen mentioned, we've got these 10 centers, and at those centers are the clinicians and the coordinators and the staff that are seeing these 700 patients over time, and they're seeing other patients as well. So this is the natural, has been the natural evolution from a series of centers that were doing our natural history study to those same centers doing continuation of natural history, but also conducting our clinical trials. Because these are where, you know, these are the centers to which our patients are coming. They're seeing physicians that they know, and the physicians know them well, and they're coming there for our clinical trials as well. So it really has been a neat package.
Wow, that's great. So the registry is only one part of how you're able to fill the clinical trials.
Absolutely, yeah, because we now call this natural history study, these centers, our collaborative clinical research network in FA. So we've evolved that from, I think we started with 7 centers doing outcome measures and beginning to build that natural history to now a 10-centered collaborative clinical network for clinical trials.
Wow. Now, have you had support from NIH through all this process? Have they been able to help you?
They are help from the NIH, and we work with them, you know, all the time. Has primarily been of two types. One is that they continue to give, you know, basic research grants throughout the community. Our investigators are good enough that they've enjoyed the benefits of those basic research grants, you know, primarily the R20, R01s and R21s and so forth. The other way that they've helped us is to help fund and lead our international scientific conferences. We've done 3 workshops right there at the NIH that they helped fund and, you know, co-hosted with us. And we're now looking for additional ways. We've participated in their, they're called their National Advisory Councils. The Neurological Institute, like in Huntington's, is our primary institute there. And I was able to serve on their National Advisory Council, along with, you know, there's always an HD rep. Right now, Robert Precipici is on that council.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
Roby Blumenstein was on it before him at the same time I was. So this is really a great way for advocates like ourselves to stay tuned to what the NIH is trying to get done, what mechanisms for funding are available, being made available, and how we can help the NIH, advocating for it and its budget and so forth. So, they've helped us, and now we're looking for additional help in terms of translational and clinical research. Those are tough nuts to crack because they're very expensive and take a long time in developing, but they're very collegial. We spend a lot of time with them and with our colleagues at the FDA. So.
Now, do you have a patient representative at the FDA?
We do. We have just gotten an FA representative inserted in that patient representative program, so we're all the way up to
wonderful.
One. And we know how important that is. And to date, that's been especially important when it comes time to apply for a new drug application. These advisory committee meetings can have that patient representative on the committee. On the other hand, we think there's a great deal that needs to be done much earlier than that. Pre-IND meetings, milestone meetings, after phase two and before phase three, and each one of those meetings, in our view, should have solid patient representation. And Jen and I and our leading clinician, Dr. Lynch at Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, have participated in a good number of pre-IND meetings, and increasingly the drug sponsor, the drug company, is inviting us. It has to be the sponsor that invites you to such a meeting. The FDA can't do it. So we're getting increasing numbers of invitations to do that. And our experience is really, astounding in that we're absolutely convinced that we're helping educate the review divisions on our disease.
Mm-hmm.
And we're helping change that conversation And there are times we've even gone into them with NIH colleagues with whom we've been working. So it changes it from this sort of adversarial confrontation almost to a very collegial.
That's wonderful.
Very tough, very hard-nosed, but collegial. We recognize that we're all trying to get the right thing done. And so that's really been important. And I'll go on one more second here and say that in the legislation of last year, that starts with the Prescription Drug User Fee Act, PDUFA, and evolved into what's called FDASIA, the FDA Innovation and Safety Act, has a new provision whereby the patient representatives you referred to, Melissa, can begin to serve not just in the advisory committees at the end of this cycle, for drug approval, but at these milestone meetings. So picture going into a pre-IND meeting and having, in your case, an HD advocate, patient, clinician sitting beside the drug sponsor, the company, and looking across the table and seeing an HD patient representative on the reviewer side of the table participating as part of the review committee. Is that a powerful paradigm or what?
And for some of those folks out there who are not familiar with IND and all these acronyms that we're using, IND is Investigational New Drug, right? And Ron, can you talk a little bit about why that's so important for patient advocates to be involved in that process?
It is absolutely essential because these are the meetings, and they're the first of the meetings that you'll be interested in. It's at these meetings that the drug sponsor, the drug company, has to go in and ask the right questions of the FDA, say, here are our plans. This is the way we want to develop this drug. This is the way we want to design the clinical trials. This is the way the phase one will look. This is how the phase two would probably look. This is how many HD patients would be involved. This is what we'd be looking for. These are the clinical outcome measures. This is the kind of signal we need from phase one. And here's the profile. Here's the safety profile of this drug in question. Here's what it looked like in healthy animals. This is what it looked like in our animal models. We think we have a strong signal of potential efficacy, effectiveness in these animal studies, and we think that this is a sufficiently safe profile these data demonstrate for you to tell us, give us the answers to our questions here. Is this the right way to go? And if so, or if not, correct our, you know, misperception here and help us submit the investigational new drug paperwork, which would be the next step. You have this meeting and you ask your questions, you get the answers, and they give a nod of assent or say, no, we do this animal study a little bit differently. You need to go 6 months instead of 3 months with this mouse, that sort of thing. And as soon as you get the additional experimentation done, we think that you're ready to submit your investigational new drug application. And when you do that, they have 30 days to say yes or no, and you can go. And so that is a very critical first step. And if you don't have a patient or a patient representative there, you're running the risk that the FDA review division will not understand the importance in a benefit-risk evaluation standpoint, that this is that clinical outcome measure measures the thing very important to patients. If they can do this better, it will be a tremendous enhancement to their quality of life. And that's why we're measuring it. And these patients have no option, no treatment option in this category, in this symptom. So they are willing to accept substantial risk to get to this benefit. If they don't have somebody at the table assuring the review division that the patient's benefit-risk ratio is, you know, in the patient's favor, then you run the risk of them saying to the drug company, we think the risk is too high, and we're not convinced the patients believe this benefit is worthy of that risk. So I'll stop. But that's
critical, yeah. Isn't it?
Yeah, it is. So, the only way you can be involved in a meeting like that is to be invited by the drug company. So it's important to work with the drug companies and let them know. Mm-hmm. Listen, you know, we're on your side here. If we believe in your drug, we believe in, you know, we should get this into clinical trials. So when you go in for your pre-IND meeting, take us along, and we'll give them the patient's voice. So.
That's very important to have a voice.
Yeah.
Now, Ron, you've been at this for a few years, so how long is it taking you to really get, you know, get accepted into that arena?
That's a great question. We've been at it for 15 years, but the good news for us was we knew from the beginning a small disease like ours and a small organization like ours could not possibly make much progress alone, and that we would collaboration were our byline. And So we knew, we started, the first meetings we had were with NIH, and then with our scientists, and then with our, you know, a lot of patient families. So we knew it was going to take everybody, and then we started meeting with drug companies. So through those years, we're just sticking with that, and with that spirit of collaboration, and you know, we like to say that we were all isolated and hopeless and helpless, and now we're, you know, we've changed it from isolation to a team, and now we're a family affair. So the public-private partnership is something that Jen and I preach, you know, daily. And now I'll tell you, Jen and I have been invited to speak at any number of international conferences and at a good number of FDA symposia. You know, they've asked us to brief review divisions, you know, on our disease and what you can accomplish in rare disease and with small clinical trials. And so and the NIH does the same thing when they hold these patient advocacy days. They always ask Jen or me or both to speak to the other advocates about, you know, the kind of business model that that's built around public-private partnership and collaboration. So it works.
And it looks like you've really put together a great stream of community events and, you know, awareness projects for the disease category. It looks like you've really done a great job in putting that all together as well. It's like the perfect package, you know, to advocate and educate and find a cure.
Jen, why don't you speak to that? Because Jen puts all that stuff together.
That's amazing.
Farah as an organization has always been what we like to call grassroots. So you heard Ron at the beginning of the show talk about how the organization was founded by him and his wife and other patient families and our research community. And so it really is everyone being involved and participating. And so, you know, a lot of the events that happen in the community throughout the year are patient families hosting events and creating opportunities to raise funds and awareness. And, you know, we have that alongside with, you know, a few patient education sessions throughout the year. And then we've got a few research community building activities that we do throughout the year in terms of conferences and things like that. I think it's very much a part of our organizational culture to build community and to have everybody involved. And I think that that also is why things like the registry and the natural history study are successful, because we've been able to, you know, everybody's a part of the effort in some way.
And everyone is not only hopeful, but now confident that there's something that will be done and there's something that they can do now. I think that's, Jen's absolutely right. That's the foundation of the success of our patient registry in natural history is people are eager to participate. They know they can make a difference. They know they can make a difference now. And they know a difference will be made for all of them by working together. So we're very fortunate.
A relationship of trust and, you know, transparency and an amazing effort to bring research to the forefront. And that's, I mean, we all want a cure for our loved ones. So what you're doing is just an amazing feat. As Health Reach International is growing, we're wanting to do something very similar. And I would just ask, you know, what would be some advice that you would have for us? Because, you know, we're 3 years old, but really we've just started our nonprofit, you know, journey. So,
well, I will take the first crack at that. I would just say, you know, the magic for us was always the knowledge from the beginning that it had to be all of us, all in. And so it meant working with government, industry, and investigators, but all based on the patients. And so the kind of trust that you've just referred to, that's the key word that Jen and I talk about all the time, is we're blessed with this trusting relationship we have with all of our patients and their families, and we must never lose sight of that and must never let them down, never break that trust. And it's on that trust that is built these other relationships. And so it's just, keeping that in your heart and mind, and working, all the time with the partnerships that you need to cross the finish line, and keep getting everybody together.
A tireless effort.
Yeah, it is a tireless effort.
Yep. And you have to have a Jen in your organization.
I think one of the questions that we talked about before the show was, what would you do differently? The only two things I could come up with were, I'd sleep less and I'd find Jen sooner. Those are the two things I'd do differently.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah.
That's funny. Well, we so appreciate you coming on, and we're so excited to be able to launch this show with our project too. And we thank you so much for all that you're doing for everybody and for helping other organizations. I mean, we're not FA, we're HD, and here you are helping us. So we're just so appreciative of you and your experience. You've got an amazing team and you've got an amazing organization that we'd love to model. And tell us what some of your fundraising activities, community events coming up, in case there's somebody out there that wants to hear about FA. Farah?
Oh, I'd love to. If you want to, we have a bike program called Ride Ataxia that will be at 6 cities this year. We'll be outside of Dallas in March, and then we'll be in Northern California near Sacramento, and then we'll be in Chicago, Seattle, Philadelphia, and Orlando.
That's awesome. And if
throughout
wants
the year,
to contact you, contact you?
Best way would be info@curefa.org.
Okay, and your website is
curefa.org. Sorry about that.
It's okay. Ron, it's such a pleasure having you on the show. You too, Jen. Thank you for all your hard work. Katie, we're going to sign off and tell everyone goodbye and good night, and we'll talk again soon. Thank you, everybody.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Great.
Bye, everybody. Bye.
Hello?
Note to self, tell people not to listen to the radio show and be on the radio show at the same time.
Hey, let me Skype you, okay?